Welcome to Anchorage Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Anchorage Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Greg Erickson of the Alaska Budget Report, and Jill Burke of the Alaska Dispatch. Greg, let's start with the inauguration of Governor Sean Parnell and Lieutenant Governor Meade Treadwell. It's always a big event in Juneau, and aside from the pageantry, the traditional pageantry, there are speeches. Tell us a little bit about the scene, and what did Governor Parnell and Lieutenant Governor Treadwell have to tell Alaskans?
Well, there was pageantry, and the pageantry was kind of fun, but Governor Parnell has never been noted for his great rhetorical skills, and so expectations, I don't think, were too high. His speech was nevertheless a disappointment. It was full of the usual rhetoric. The federal government is the source of all our problems.
But didn't it strike you that that was the first thing he mentioned was the federal government after he got out of the salutations and appreciations of all the people in the room?
And, you know, he went on to say such things as that the great characteristic of Alaskans that sets us apart is our common sense, and notably absent elsewhere in the country. And, you know, these things play well in the political campaigns, I guess. But I don't think they add much to the debate and to the. So I find it a very unimpressive speech. But, and I studied it carefully because I knew you were going to ask this question. I looked at Lieutenant Governor Meade Treadwell's speech, and by contrast, that was a very moving, speech. It was very personal, talked about the characteristics that he saw his father give to his family, and related those to what he's going to try to do as Lieutenant Governor. And he wants to be a coach, he wants to be a mediator, he wants to do whatever Parnell wants him to do, and these are his skills. And I thought it was a very good speech, and it was very well received, and I guess it tells us perhaps that Lieutenant Governor Treadwell hasn't learned the first duty of a Lieutenant Governor, which is to not outshine the governor.
That, and it would seem that the first thing on his plate would be to find out what's going on in the Division of Elections while their lawsuits proceed.
Well, perhaps he didn't mention elections.
Well, I could see why he'd want to stay on topics that are more.
He did, in a roundabout way. He congratulated outgoing Lieutenant Governor Campbell. And, you know, I think those congratulations are probably well-deserved. They've been under a tremendous magnifying glass and a lot of scrutiny. And I'm familiar with the Supreme Court decisions that have animated the decisions that the Department of Law has been recommending to the elections people. And Gail, who's the director.
Funumiai,
yeah, thank you. And it's clear that the Alaska Supreme Court wants the election officials to bend over backwards to try to decipher what people wanted to say, I think. Maybe Jill has a different view on this. I don't know.
Either of our other guests have thoughts on the governor's opening speech, his inauguration speech, Paul, any thoughts?
What he said.
Okay. Then let's go ahead here. Greg, and Governor Parnell recently announced personnel changes at the top of his administration, some very big changes, people who are especially in resources and at the Attorney General's office. What did you make of those changes, the new people? And I'm sort of curious as a second-tier question here. What do you think he wants and expects in the Attorney General?
I don't know. It's a wrong answer to give you, but there's used to have a group of people called Kremlinologists who would read the tea leaves about who was standing on the monuments at the Red May Day parade, and we're sort of doing the same thing, looking at who's out, who's in. But it's a huge turnover, and there's no question, there have been 100 resignations that have been requested, and only about 20% of them, the top people, have been acted upon so far, according to Mike Nizek, the newly...
Who was one of them himself for a while, right?
Right, and who was just recently confirmed to be chief of staff. Remarkable career. Mike Nizek has served governors going all the way back to Jay Hammond, and in very senior positions, too. But I think there's a couple things we can deduce from what we've seen so far. One is that he, in general, wants, I don't think he wants the kind of charismatic people that maybe Sarah Palin was comfortable having. And that his attorney general is someone he met during his law practice that almost nobody has heard of, at least in Anchorage and Juneau, maybe the Fairbanks.
But he's well known in Fairbanks, yeah. And I should disclose I'm a friend of his father's. I don't know John Burns Jr. as well, but he's well regarded in Fairbanks, but he's not a resource lawyer. I don't think anybody knows him in that sense.
Yeah. Now, the most startling choices were a 31-year-old woman for Commissioner of Fish and Game. That's startling because I think there's only one commissioner in Alaska's history who was younger than 31 years old, and that would have been Byron Mallott, who was commissioner of a much smaller department at age 28.
He was the first commissioner.
That's right. So that's remarkable. Fish and Game is a huge bureaucracy with a lot of old people in it, and many retiring, actually. So it'll be interesting to see whether that gets confirmed. The other really interesting thing was the story that the Juneau Empire focused on Friday, and that was that Board of Education, which is supposed to choose the Commissioner of Education, basically got its marching orders from Governor Parnell and sent him back the name that he wanted. And they had earlier said they were going to have a application process and they were going to interview candidates, and they didn't do any of that. They just rubber stamped what the governor
wanted.
Let's
get Paul in here, and then we'll go to Jill. Paul, do you see any ideological evidence in this? He's looking for ideological choices, competency, comfort zone. What do you make of this?
I don't think so. I think ideology doesn't play any role in this. I think he's reaching out to people who are going to end up owing everything they have in state government to him. He's looking for loyalty. He's looking for people he can depend on. He's looking for people that owe nobody else their allegiance. I think he learned that from Sarah Palin. I think it's a good lesson if you're a politician, but I think that's what he's doing. He's reached out to a 31-year-old fish and game commissioner with an education degree, no management experience at all. There's a person that's going to owe him. He reaches down to Kincaid Elementary School for his education commissioner, to a man who's probably a nice man, a good guy, but not very well known in the education community, from what I'm told, yet he's going to be the education commissioner. These are people that are his people. They're not Palin's people. They're not somebody else's people. They're his.
Thank you, Paul. Let's go turn to Jill. Jill, the big news, the election is not over. It ain't over till it's over. Yogi Berra was wrong about that. It doesn't seem like it's ever going to be over, but who knows? The Joe Miller saga rolls on and on. You've been following Miller's post-election activities and can give us a pretty good summary of what's happened and where are we today as we're waiting to hear from the court, the state court.
Right. Today at this very moment, we're expecting the first ruling from a judge, which would be a decision on summary judgment, either on Miller's behalf or the state's behalf, or perhaps some type of blended ruling about whether or not there needs to be this strict interpretation applied to the ballots in terms of perfection, perfectly written names that follow form and spelling, or the State of Alaska and Division of Elections contention that there is room for interpretation, meaning that if you can discern voter intent, that some misspellings are acceptable, provided that it's obvious that that's the candidate for whom the voter intended to cast their ballot. So anyway, we're here. The state court is expected to render a decision on Friday today. They have already indicated, the parties, that they will elevate that to the Alaska Supreme Court, regardless of what the decision may be, particularly if it's a decision against Miller. Miller has further indicated that regardless of what decision he gets at any state level, he will continue his fight in federal court, all of which is dragging out the timeline to certify this election and get a senator seated for the state.
Well, the one thing I think many of our viewers and the public in general finds confusing is even if Miller had ballots thrown out, many of the ballots he's challenged, they wouldn't be enough to overturn Murkowski's victory. That's the way it seems to the layperson.
It does, and I think that's accurate to an extent. I think that the Miller team is hoping that taking all of the vulnerabilities that they've attempted to raise with the ballot count, which includes both the methodology, which is established by Alaska law, and what interpretation of that should be allowed, applies to some 8,000 votes. And a couple other thousand others that are on the fringes of that. even if that all goes Miller's way, that's not enough to close the gap entirely. But he's identified these other problems. Felons potentially voted. There was impropriety in some precincts. Maybe voters weren't properly identified or accounted for. Perhaps there was ballot mishandling.
Wouldn't he have to show this on a very large scale to get away from a court saying no harm, no foul?
He would. And that's one of the state's arguments, is that the state has, for good reason, imposed a very high standard for election contests, meaning there has to be some demonstration that this can be reasonably overcome to even take it up, to make it worth the effort. They're arguing he hasn't met that burden. He's saying, look, we don't know if we've met the burden because there's all these problems, and if you add them up all together between the problems identified just with the process and potential fraud or impropriety, in addition to the, you know, U.S. election and voters' rights that we believe we can wage on the federal level, we couple all these together, we don't know. And it's not fair for you to make a decision because we don't know, and we have a right to exercise and investigate that.
Greg?
You know, there's sort of two ways the press goes about covering things like this. And the one way is, well, on the one hand, you have these people saying this, and on the other hand, you have the other side saying this. You decide. But I think it's been interesting that the Associated Press, and what I think is sort of a departure from the past recent practice in Alaska, actually came out and said Murkowski won. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was very interesting. I don't know what the other media have done on that, because I haven't followed all the reporting. But
I think apparent winner, presumptive winner. Technically, she hasn't been certified. And until the state certifies her, I don't think that she has technically won. She's not able to be seated until that takes place. But the common belief, and the people that we have spoken with and that I have personally spoken with, national analysts who follow politics and who follow the Senate, say it's clear to everybody that Murkowski won, and should be clear to Miller if it isn't. Mm-hmm. And therefore, that makes his attempts to wage this contest questionable in the sense of the declaration of his motives. He said it's integrity, but really, if he knows that the numbers are against him and that he is not the winner, it's about something else.
Jill, Miller's latest campaign report, spending report, is available. What does it tell us? And I think one of the things it tells us is that he's repaid himself some of the loan he made, right?
I believe so, and Paul may be able to speak to that more in depth than I can. But he gave himself a loan to begin this campaign. He's repaid some of that money. He's also continued to fundraise since the election closed.
And so has Murkowski.
Done very well. Yes, they both have.
Paul. Why don't you address that about him paying back the loan himself?
He had a $103,000 loan that he levied and put in his campaign early on. There's some indication he's paid that back with a little bit more than $103,000. It's difficult to see exactly where it went. He ended the election cycle on election day. It was $700,000 in the bank still, which I find amazing. Since then,
although a significant amount, according to the Daily News story, came in on the last 48 hours.
48 hours. Yeah. Well, yeah, it did. And then you've got another $250,000, mostly, oddly enough, from Jim DeMint of South Carolina. Jim DeMint of South Carolina has got a lot to do with driving this effort. This guy basically is trying to stack the Senate with ultra-conservative Republicans, and to do that, he spent almost $6 million, and about $700,000 of that has gone to. Has gone to Miller's campaign over this time. As recently as a few days ago, he was sending out flyers urging people to give money to Miller for what's coming down to a lawyer's Full Employment Act case. I don't know how this is going to turn out, but there's going to be a lot of people making money over it until it dies.
There is a considerable speculation over Miller's motives. Any thoughts? I mean, it does seem like that this is a far stretch to think he could.
I'm left wondering why, when the math is the way it is, there's no way to win, really. You can knock down the big numbers, you can pick away at the little numbers, you can get the votes from two-legged people with two left feet, but you're still not going to come up with enough votes to knock off. I don't know why.
I sort of wondered if it was, I've been in this for so long and I want this. This is my shot at the brass ring. Maybe they'll find something.
I think we're talking about, this is an effort by certain members of Tea Party, Jim DeMint et al., just get rid of Lisa Murkowski one way or the other. And they're going to spend whatever it takes, do whatever it takes to do that. And that's what I see this as. He's got no reason to pursue this.
And we had explored this too. And so there's these theories.
Yes, it was like, a very good story you did.
Thank you. There's, you know, the Tea Party likes a rebel. It's just good for his image if he has some kind of future political aspirations. That the longer he fights and the more resolutely he fights, that he reinforces that image. He keeps his name in the media
cycle. Gets to quote John Paul Jones.
Right. He continues. And so the second component of that is fundraising. He continues to raise money while this legal battle continues. A third option is that he wants to, if he was unable to beat Murkowski, that he can still kind of have the last word by possibly disempowering her, affecting her rank on committees, affecting potentially her seniority. There's some question about whether or not that would even be a legitimate technique, because ultimately it's going to be up to the Senate. There's even some theories that it's just DeMint saying, look, if Miller didn't get in, Murkowski's on the, you know, the Energy and Resources Committee. One of my guys is in line to potentially ascend to rank on that. Let's go that route.
He tried to get her off. He tried to knock her down.
He did.
Ranking
and
Republican.
It failed. And one of the analysts that we spoke with said, you know, it's a risky proposition, because that actually could end up hurting both Miller and DeMint in the long run if they drag this out too much. And it could potentially hurt the state of Alaska to have a vacant Senate seat.
Greg, put on your historian's hat here. Where does Joe Miller fit in the history of people who've run for the United States Senate in Alaska, or held high office with governorship as well?
Well, there are plenty of examples in the past where the Republican Party nominated somebody that was too far to the right to be elected to high office. Republican John Birch Society member by the name of C.R. Lewis was nominated, and I believe that that nomination had a lot to do with the fact that Mike Gravel, I think, was the one who was the Democrat against him.
He was reelected.
Against him. That was despite a lot of discomfort with Mr. Gravel at that time in the state. The other thing that comes to mind is that, you know, Sarah Palin resigned her governorship, and there were people who said, well, that's the end of her. And yet, as Jill has pointed out, you know, there's in this evolving mix of politics in this country, a constituency that may be very animated by his fight to the death and for stand up for, quote, principle.
Very well said. Okay, we got to return to home here, Paul. The Anchorage Assembly passed a budget. Their dealings with the mayor, while at some points contentious, didn't seem to have the rancor that we have been subjected to in some other years. What happened?
I don't know. It was a piece of cake.
And tell us how much it was.
The walk in the park, $435 million budget. Property taxes will go up about 1.5%. That's the smallest increase in recent memory, I think anybody can remember. Aside from something called the East Anchorage Plan and some bus routes, there'll be 30 or so positions in the city done away with to save money. It would take something like $14 million more added to this budget just to maintain the services that we have now next year. So all in all, it's a bare bones, tight budget done with everybody getting on board. It's unusual.
Okay, thank you. Greg, I'm thinking that while we have you here, we should draw on your experience and your expertise as an economist. Trans-Alaska Gas Line, and also with our friends over at the Bitters. Tell us about that.
Well, it's also sort of a story about the press, too, in a way. I think that TransCanada and Exxon are the designated GEA promoters of the pipeline with the state's backing, and they had said last summer that they were hoping to have their gas line capacity committed, that shippers would come forward and sign contracts or at least give them tentative commitments to ship a pipeline full of gas by the end of this year. And it's my understanding that until the AP reporter down in Juneau, Becky Bohr, picked up the phone and called them up, they hadn't heard from any news media people, and the TransCanada people said, doesn't look like we're going to make it, which was a big story, I think. But in the end, it really doesn't make much difference, because the state has already committed to go ahead, seek FERC authority regardless. And So in one sense, it's a big story. In another sense, perhaps it's just another little bump on the road that has been very bumpy.
What can our viewers expect, let's say, from the first quarter of next year from TransCanada and the legislature? Because the legislature somehow is going to want to get involved or find out what's going on or voice an opinion?
Well, the legislature has already appropriated about $100 million of the $500 million the state has committed to help move this project towards FERC certification, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission certification. But whether it is in this session, I suspect it will be, the legislature is probably going to be asked to pony up some additional cash to meet that commitment. Now, it's a contractual commitment, but I'm sure that never stopped legislators from bloviating about how awful it is that we have to spend this money. And some people at this table have expressed some negative views about whether it was a good investment or not.
Presumably they weren't bloviating.
No.
So Paul, somehow it turns out that by coincidence, it's your turn.
Thank you.
I'm going to jump in here on TransCanada.
I frankly didn't expect them to have this together by the end of the year, and I'm still waiting for the governor to tell us what he knew about the whole process, which he said he would do after the election. Well, here we are, so we're not going to see it. Gas prices are low. I don't think there's going to be any huge stampede to run out there and do anything to get this thing going. I'm still a skeptic. I'd be really surprised if this gets built.
Okay.
But I think that we're going to have to wait a long time to find out.
It's going to be, we'll have, yeah. What's your, how old are you now? 41?
He doesn't have to answer that question. Jill, let's turn to something completely different once again. Salmon leather. Many of our viewers might not know there is such a thing, but you've written about it, and it's an entertaining possibility.
It is, and it's not a new thing. People have been using salmon leather for years, personal harvest, to make, waterproof boots or raincoats, but certainly not on a mass scale. We're starting to see that on a mass scale internationally. And in fact, one, I think it's a German company, has opened up an office in LA, and these are really high-end commercial productions that are selling swaths of this that get used for the fashion industry. People, you could show up maybe next time with a salmon leather tie or perhaps your own very, nice jacket. Beautiful high-end dresses. BMW has lined some of its vehicles with it. Luxury lots are using it for upholstery. I mean, it's kind of crazy.
Can you tell us, how do we get from a salmon that's on this table to the leather on a luxury car seat? What's the process?
The process is proprietary. I tried to get that out of the one guy in the state here who is doing it on a small scale, kind of an individual scale, and he didn't want to talk too much about it. But it's a regular tanning process, and so the ones that are being successful in Europe are doing it utilizing hatchery fish, and they are taking off the skins or putting it through whatever process they put it through. I'm told it doesn't smell like fish, but it's attractive. People like it as a high-end leather that is eco-friendly, that looks like python. It's lightweight, it's durable, it's flexible. So one of the questions was, okay, great, we have this amazing fishing resource here, an amazing salmon resource here. Why aren't we seeing something on that scale here in Alaska? It seems like it would be a natural question. Turns out our processing right now just really doesn't accommodate that type of an industry, because there just isn't a market, according to the folks that I talked to, for skin off fillets. So everything is just farmed out, cut up, skin on. Or if the skin is taken off because it's getting reprocessed or packaged into something else, that's usually happening out of state. And by then, it's too small and really not worth the time, effort, or expense.
And did you tell me this is good news for the pythons?
It could be good news for the python. We're told that that's kind of, it's an alternative. Yeah.
Our economists can't resist.
10 years ago, my kids gave me a salmon leather wallet.
Mm-hmm.
And back in those days, I didn't have the back problems I have now, and I wore it in my back pocket, and it started to stink.
Uh-oh.
Smelled like fish.
So that's good. See, that's good to know.
Well, I hope they have a better process.
Okay.
And there was one actual commercial production facility in Juneau, but it went out of business shortly after it really was starting to get underway.
Okay. We have time for only one more question. Let's stick with Jill because it fits into our time schedule and it is important. Now for our science lesson of the day. Is there not a dam across the Bering Strait in our future?
I would suggest there is probably not one in the future.
But you've been reporting on this.
People are entertaining that notion. People entertained it decades ago as a way to perhaps promote thawing in the Arctic to make life better. Now it's being pitched as a way to potentially promote freezing in the Arctic and combat the effect of climate change. And so there have been these massive engineering conceptual designs talked about that might be functional, but scientists will tell you that geoengineering is a bad idea, that once you start kind of tinkering with the world's air conditioner and these large systems, you cause a large potential for calamity in other areas, not to mention the marine mammal migrations that take place up in the Arctic.
By the way, I love the art in the dispatch of the polar bear on an ice floe at the foot of a dam.
Thank you. I will pass that on to our illustrator. So we got a lot of feedback on that story, and most of it is just like, we can't believe that you're actually taking this seriously. But I heard from the Dutch science writer who had actually put this idea forward 2 or 3 years ago quite seriously. And his point was, he's not recommending this, but he really thinks that the conversation needs to be open, not just to mitigation for climate change issues, but also maybe taking this a step further in conjunction
with
other
things.
Well,
we have to do some mitigation here. We're out of time. Thank you for joining us on Anchorage Edition. We'll see you next week. Right here.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Anchorage Edition at anchorageedition@kakm.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Anchorage Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.